From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a pivotal nation that lies between Europe and Asia, a country whose Islamic religion and culture were suppressed in the 1920s in favor of a modern secular state. We talk about Turkey with journalist Stephen Kinzer. He was the New York Times Istanbul bureau chief from 1996 to 2000. His new book, Crescent and Star, is about Turkey's continuing struggle toward modernity. He says Turkey now has the ability to become a true Muslim democracy, but it's not there yet. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Love and Theft, the new CD by Bob Dylan. By the way, its official release date was September 11th. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. What had been reported earlier as the hijacking of an Indian jetliner now appears to have been a false alarm. Passengers and crew are reported to be safely off the plane on the ground in New Delhi. The Indian government says the hijacking was a false alarm caused by an anonymous phone call. There were never any hijackers on board. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson insisted that the nation is prepared to face a bioterrorist attack, but others on a Senate hearing were not so sure. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
Thompson repeated assertions he made in a network interview Sunday that his department and the nation's health system are well prepared to detect and cope with potential germ warfare. But local officials told the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee that oversees HHS that much more needs to be done. A Colorado emergency physician who participated in a mock attack said hospitals would degenerate into chaos if faced with too large an influx of patients. And an Iowa epidemiologist said she can't reach most public health officials outside of normal business hours. When an animal at a petting zoo tested positive for rabies on a Saturday, she said, those exposed could not be notified until Monday morning. Both Thompson and other senators called for Congress to provide more funding to help prepare for a potential attack. Julie Rovner, NPR News, the Capitol.
According to some former CIA and FBI spy experts, the United States would have to eliminate Afghanistan's Taliban regime in order to get rid of Osama bin Laden's terrorist network. The former chief of counterterrorism for the Central Intelligence Agency testified on Capitol Hill that bin Laden cannot exist without the Taliban and that removing him means removing the Taliban. Vincent Canestraro also warns the U.S. should not lose its focus by considering an attack now on other areas such as Iraq. Former Palestinian negotiator Hanan Ashrawi arrived in Cairo today where she met with Egyptian foreign minister. She told reporters she hoped that the current crisis will lead to a reassessment of U.S. policies in the Middle East. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports from Cairo.
Ashrawi is in Egypt for Arab League talks in advance of a conference designed to coordinate the Arab response to terrorism. Ashrawi was heartened to hear President Bush's recent comments that the U.S. has always envisioned a Palestinian state as part of the solution in the Middle East.
It could be verbal, it could be lip service, it could be the carrot to get the Arabs and the Islamic world on board. But the thing is, let's deal with it in good faith. Let's assume there is this commitment. How are we going to move ahead with it? To give it substance and reality.
Ashrawi hopes that as the U.S. courts Arab countries, they will insist on a deeper engagement in Palestinian issues. Meanwhile, Israel is also applying pressure, calling on the international community to brand Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Hezbollah as terrorist organizations. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Cairo.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 173, the Nasdaq closed up 88. This is NPR News. The Greek government says it will be prepared for the 2004 Olympics, despite construction delays that have alarmed the International Olympic Committee. NPR's Howard Berkus has more.
The Olympic construction schedule was the focus of a Greek government cabinet meeting, and afterwards, government officials vowed to overcome their difficulties in meeting deadlines. Last week, an inspection team from the International Olympic Committee warned that preparations for the Athens Olympics were behind schedule. The IOC inspectors were especially concerned about delays in building Olympic venues, roads, rail lines, and housing. A government official says the cabinet developed a plan to get preparations on track. He also says Greece will revise its $600 million security plan in response to the September 11th attacks in the United States. Next February's Winter Games in Salt Lake City will be used as a model for security changes. International Olympic Committee inspectors return to Athens next month, hoping to see specific proposals for meeting construction deadlines. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
The National Football League says the Super Bowl will be played February 3rd in New Orleans. That means there will be a full and normal playoff schedule with 12 teams in the playoffs. The league had reached an agreement to switch dates with the National Association of Automobile Dealers, which had planned a convention in New Orleans on the first weekend of February. To cover the cost of the switch, the league is paying a reported $7.5 million to the auto dealers. Senator Joseph Biden says President Bush has some time to conduct his war on terrorism and Osama bin Laden. Biden, who chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, says the American people understand the importance of making sure it gets done right. He made the remarks at an informal luncheon at the State Department today. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The conflict between secularism and Islam in Turkey is one of the issues Stephen Kinzer explores in his new book, Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. Kinzer is a New York Times reporter who became the paper's first bureau chief in Istanbul in 1996 and remained in that position until last year. He's now a national correspondent. He says that Turks take pride in the way their country has been modernized since 1923, when Mustafa Kemal Atatürk created a new secularized state after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. But although the country's current leadership considers itself the defender of democracy and modernity, it fears free and open debate and crushes challenges wherever they appear. Stephen Kinzer, where does Turkey fit in to the coalition that President Bush is putting together?
Right now, the Bush administration is looking for countries in the area near where the expected action is going to happen. Countries that have large military infrastructures, military bases, large amounts of airspace, and political structures that will allow the United States to operate from those bases without domestic or other problems. Turkey is the country that fulfills that. So in the short run, in the medium run, Turkey's going to play a role, and has already indicated that it will play a role, as a supporter of the U.S. military effort in whatever way that it can. Turkey, however, has a greater long-term role to play in this coalition. If we accept the view, as I think most Americans, including President Bush, do, that this is going to be a drawn-out conflict that will be as much a conflict over hearts and minds as over territory or body counts, then Turkey has a huge role to play. Turkey is the closest thing we have on earth to a Muslim country that is ruled democratically. It is the country that can show the Muslim world another way. It is, in a sense, the anti-bin Laden, the anti-Taliban, the secular, modern, European, Western-oriented society that is still true to its Islamic roots. If that example can shine through the Muslim world, it can change that world and, in so doing, affect the whole world.
But at the same time, Turkey, I think, has a reputation for suppressing Islam in the country.
Turkey's in a very interesting situation if you compare it with Afghanistan. You could hardly imagine a more extreme contrast in the Islamic world. In fact, there probably is none. Afghanistan is a country where the most extreme forms of religious devotion are incorporated into government policy. In Turkey, we're at the opposite extreme. Even modest aspects of religious devotion, modest displays of piety and religious belief are thought of as scary. A woman who wears a headscarf cannot get a government job. An officer in the army who prays regularly is probably not going to be promoted and will sooner or later be cashiered from the army. Turkey has gone to the opposite extreme, and in one sense, it's gone, I think, too far. it has put itself in the position where some religious believers feel that they need to choose between their religious belief and their fidelity to the state. No country that has ever placed itself in competition with religion has ever emerged successful from that conflict.
Well, because Turkey is playing such an interesting role now in the conflicts between secularism and religion, why don't we kind of look at the history behind that? Let's go back to, 1923, when Mustafa Kemal Atatürk became the ruler of Turkey. You say no nation was ever founded with greater revolutionary zeal than the Turkish Republic, nor has any undergone more sweeping change in such a short time. You describe Mustafa Kemal Atatürk as a one-man revolution who was obsessed with progress. You say he abolished the Ottoman regime and the Islamic caliphate with the stroke of a pen. What are some of the major changes he made after coming to power? Changes having to do with religion and secularism.
There is hardly a figure in this century who brought more dramatic and radical change to his society than Atatürk did. He took over a country that had been shattered by defeat in war and dismemberment of what had been the Ottoman Empire. He took it over with the conviction that Turkey's greatest challenge was to modernize itself. He realized that Turkey had fallen far behind the countries of Western Europe, which were his models, and he decided that had to change. He was a whirlwind in Turkish society. He banned the fez, he banned the headscarf for women, he changed the Muslim calendar to the Christian calendar, he made Sunday rather than Friday the day of rest, he banned polygamy, he legalized divorce. He went through a series of changes that revolutionized Turkish society, but particularly in the area of religion, he had a very important effect. Up until the end of the Ottoman Empire, there had been no real separation between secular and religious power. Atatürk destroyed that. Atatürk felt that the state must be secular in all regards and that there was no place for religion in public policy. Over a period of 75 years, that policy has now been so ingrained in the Turkish way of looking at the world that even people who are pious religious believers, in many cases, accept the idea that they are living in a secular society. This is a precept that is not widely embraced, or universally embraced, certainly, in the Islamic world. It's a precept that Turkey needs to preach more aggressively.
Now, you quote Atatürk as having said, "A civilized international dress is worthy and appropriate for our nation, and we will wear it. Boots or shoes on our feet, trousers on our legs, shirt and tie jacket and waistcoat. And, of course, to complete these, a cover with a brim on our heads. This head covering is called hat." I'm thinking, what must it have been like for people in Turkey to get this ruling from on high that now they're going to change their clothes and adopt, you know, jackets and ties or you know, shoes and, you know, Western hats? I mean, it wasn't an organic process. It was, you know, your leader saying, okay, you're going to abandon the clothes you've always worn and wear these instead.
Probably at the time that Atatürk was in power, which was the 1920s and 30s, there was no way that any of these reforms could have been imposed other than by fiat. If there had been a plebiscite on these reforms, probably the reforms would have lost. In fact, the whole idea of having a plebiscite, of consulting the people about the direction of society or the nation, would have struck most people of that time as quite absurd. This was very much a top-down revolution. It has now been internalized by many Turks, by most Turks, I'm sure. But at the time, probably the benign dictatorship of Atatürk was the only way it could have been imposed. There was resistance to it, needless to say. Essentially, what Atatürk was doing, not just by changing the clothing of the Turks, but by changing so much in their daily lives, was to rip them apart from the traditions that many of them had lived by for centuries. For example, this changing of the script did not, from the Arabic script to the Latin script did not just mean that people had to learn a new alphabet. It meant that suddenly all of the poetry and all of the other literary works that had been produced by Turks over centuries were now going to become illegible to new generations of Turks. It was a huge and very wrenching project, probably among the most revolutionary of this century. But Atatürk felt it was the only option for Turkey if Turkey wanted to avoid the fate that he saw already absorbing many other Muslim countries, which was to be held back in those soft desert sands and never to be able to advance to the role of playing a leadership position in the civilized world. Turkey is now in a position where it can do that. It's still a little reluctant to look outward beyond its borders, but it needs to do so at this moment.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Kinzer. He's a New York Times reporter who was the bureau chief in Istanbul, Turkey, from 1996 to 2000. He has a new book called Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times reporter Stephen Kinzer. He's the author of the book Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. He was the New York Times bureau chief in Istanbul from 1996 to 2000. You know, we mentioned some of the clothing changes that Atatürk initiated. He also banned the veil for women. How did Atatürk become so westernized himself?
Atatürk was born in what is now Northern Greece. The Balkans were really the heart of the Ottoman Empire. When the Ottoman Empire collapsed, Turkey was left with Anatolia, that is the region that we now call Turkey, what used to be called Asia Minor. That was a historical accident. The real heart of the Ottoman Empire was the Balkans, and it was the cosmopolitanism of the Balkans that made it so perfect in to play a role in the imagination of Ottomans, people like Atatürk. The Balkans was a cauldron of nationalities, but it also reflected the best of the Ottoman Empire, which was no desire to convert people from one religion to another, large amount of regional and local autonomy, and a great deal of ethnic mixing. Atatürk came out of this tradition and then joined the Turkish military. In that role, he traveled both in the Islamic world and in Europe. He was able to see quite dramatically the contrast between the two. Coming home, he realized that the only hope for Turkey was modernization. During World War I, Atatürk was a young Turkish officer who won the only major battlefield victory that Turks won during World War I. That was the battle that was fought between Turks and the expeditionary force sent by Winston Churchill to the peninsula of Gallipoli. He emerged from World War I as the only legitimate hero of the Turkish army, and when the Ottoman Empire collapsed soon thereafter, he was the logical person to whom Turks turned. It so happened that his background had given him this fervent passion for modernization and westernization, and that was a huge stroke of good fortune for Turkey.
When Atatürk was westernizing and he wanted people to stop wearing the fez and the veil, did he try to also institute a set of punishments for people who wore the fez or the veil in public?
The great punishment was really social pressure. Turks, remember, had come out of a tradition in which the state, the leader, was a holy thing. The Ottoman Sultan was to be obeyed. For many years, the Sultan was also the Caliph of Islam. So the tradition that Turks developed over centuries of obedience to the will of the state was something very much ingrained in them. when the Ottoman sultans taught them that they were masters of a multicultural empire that stretched over vast dominions and that they were God's servants on earth, they accepted that. When Ataturk came to power and told them they had fallen far behind the world, needed to westernize, couldn't wear articles of clothing that he thought showed their ignorance or their unwillingness to accept what he called universal civilization, he was willing to do away with that. However, there was no sweeping punishment of people. It was well understood in Turkey that the veil was no longer favored by those in power, neither was the fez. That was enough to force people to change their habits.
How did religious leaders in Turkey respond to this almost force-fed secularism in Turkey?
At the beginning, there was resistance. In fact, in some cases, it was armed resistance. Ataturk responded by setting up what he called independence courts, which were essentially tribunals for people who were rebelling against the government. And several hundred people were condemned and executed by order of these courts. The religious leaders in Turkey did not naturally embrace these reforms, in large measure because these reforms implied, inevitably, a loss in the authority and the role of religious leaders. The abolition of the dervish sects and other religious orders also played an important role in galvanizing some religious factions against Ataturk. But his power was such, and his ability to seduce large numbers of people from the Islamic community and the Islamic clergy allowed him to overcome these obstacles. Certainly, if there had been a regime of civil liberties and courts like the one we know today, it would have been impossible to impose these reforms because they were resisted by many traditionalists in Turkey. But at that time, the methods that Ataturk used proved sufficient to bring most of the population to his side. I will say this, though. There's a myth in Turkey propagated by school books and official discourse that all Turks, soon after Ataturk arrived in power, embraced his reforms. That's not true, and it's not true to this day. There are still people who, if they were really free to say so, would complain that Ataturk went too far. Turkey's challenge now is to ease up enough so that religious believers can feel they have a full place in society and incorporate them into what is already a very vibrant and multifaceted society that can prove a very valuable model to other Islamic countries, especially at this moment.
What kinds of restrictions are there against religion now?
As I mentioned earlier, one of the aspects of Turkish life is the fear of religious symbols. The secular establishment doesn't like seeing professional women, for example, wearing headscarves. They're allowed to do this in their own businesses, but they're not allowed to act, for example, as judges or lawyers or civil servants when wearing a headscarf. Religious garb for men, traditional robes and turbans, is also outlawed. But what's more important, I think, and what I think is more irritating to some Turks is that any instruction in religion that is not sanctioned by the state is also suspect. If a father, for example, spends his evenings talking about the Quran with his children and some other neighborhood children start showing up, and pretty soon, twice a week, this fellow's house fills up with some local kids to discuss religious themes, that person might well find himself visited by the police. He might be asked if he's running a Quran school without a permit. There are these so-called underground Quran schools, which in many cases are just informal discussion groups. The government, however, is terrified that they are the germ of something more serious, more profound, more dangerous. Therefore, religious teaching is to be done within limits that are set by the government. Even many of the imams who preach in mosques in Turkish towns and in the neighborhoods of Turkish cities receive their sermons or outlines of their sermons from a central directorate of religious affairs that is part of the Turkish government. So there's a considerable effort on the part of the government to assure that what people are learning about religion has been officially sanctioned. The people function outside this consensus. There are a number of religious schools in which religion is brought closer to the center of the curriculum. But even in those schools, textbooks are supposed to be approved by the government.
You said that there are certain beliefs that can't be spoken in Turkey. Like what?
Beliefs that are outside the consensus of what Turks are supposed to believe are punishable by law. There is now a project at this moment, as we're speaking, in the Turkish parliament to change these laws. But at the moment, insulting the army, insulting national leaders, insulting the memory of Atatürk, supporting the idea of ethnic diversity, these are ideas that are considered very dangerous. If you speak these ideas, you are in legal danger. I give you one example that I use in my book. A friend of mine who's a Turkish journalist wrote a book in which she interviewed veterans of the war between Turks and Kurdish separatists. These were army veterans. She found a lot of them very upset with the way they were treated in the army. They had bad things to say about the army. They didn't feel so terribly about the people they were supposed to fight. They became very confused. They disliked their officers. In a sense, they reacted the way young soldiers have reacted to any war. That woman who put that book together was arrested. She ultimately was found not guilty, but she had to go through two trials because just by printing the statements of young kids who said the army doesn't serve our interests, the army doesn't care about us, the people we're fighting against might be right, we might be wrong, those views were considered hostile to the state, and for that she was prosecuted.
Stephen Kinzer is the author of the new book Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. He's the former Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times and is now a national correspondent for the Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Turkey's relationship with other Islamic countries. We continue our conversation with journalist Stephen Kinzer, author of Crescent and Star. And Ken Tucker reviews Bob Dylan's new CD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Stephen Kinzer, author of Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. Kinzer was the New York Times Istanbul bureau chief from 1996 to 2000. He's now a national correspondent. In the first part of our talk, he described how in the 1920s, under the leadership of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, Turkey became a modern, secular state. But in doing so, the state repressed certain public expressions of Islamic religion and culture, a practice which continues to this day. You've used the word tolerance to describe the Turkish government, but in some ways the government doesn't sound tolerant at all if you're not able to wear religious garments in public. That's a suppression of free speech and freedom of religion the way we would define it in the United States.
Turkey is often described, and I think quite aptly, as a half-democracy or a country on the way to democracy. Certainly it's the most democratic of all the 50 or so Muslim countries on earth. It cannot honestly be considered a full democracy, however, for the reasons that you point out. When Turkey was founded in the 1920s, there were all kinds of threats to this very fragile new regime, including threats from Orthodox religious leaders. It made sense in those days for certain views to be suppressed because the Atatürk reforms could never have taken place without that repression. Those days are over now. Turks are as vibrant and open and anxious a society as any on earth. They really want to make their mark on the world. They're being held back by a sclerotic cadre of ruling groups that is unwilling to give up its own power. This is a cadre that is afraid that any expression of religious beliefs is going to lead to radical fundamentalism. Any expression of ethnic diversity is going to lead to violent separatism. It's a philosophy based on fear. Turkey and most Turks have gotten far beyond that. The regime is still lagging behind, and that is creating a great frustration in Turkey. People want to move forward towards full democracy more quickly than their leaders want to let them do so.
Well, you know, you would like to think that Turkey can be a model for other states with predominantly Muslim populations about how you could have a democracy. But if the cost of democracy is suppressing religion, it seems like a big cost, and it also seems like a price, you know, no other country is going to be paying right now.
Turkey needs to make some fundamental decisions. Turkey can become a hugely important model to the Muslim world, but in order to do that, Turkey has to change itself. Turkey, at the moment, is a country where certain beliefs cannot be spoken, certain political positions cannot be held, where writers are still put in prison for what they write, where people can be arrested for statements they make in public, not for actions, for newspaper columns. That has to stop if Turkey is going to play the role that it can play in the world. These days, it has suddenly become much more important for the world that there be a true Muslim democracy. Therefore, it's more important than ever that we try to work with the country that is closer than any other to that goal, which is Turkey, to try to help it complete that march toward democracy. If the world can help Turkey overcome a handful of psychological and political barriers that have inhibited its political development, that will be great for Turks and great for Turkey and also great for the whole world.
You know, you mentioned in your book that two-thirds of Turks now are under the age of 35. That's, I guess, a big demographic shift. And that a lot of young people aren't obeying the way they used to, the way people used to, that they're impatient for change and impatient with leaders who are preventing it. Can you talk a little bit more about what you think the long-term effect might be of this large number of people who are under the age of 35?
They can be a very positive influence on Turkey. They are the ones who are demanding that the lid be taken off, that people be allowed to speak and write and express themselves in Turkey just as they can in fully democratic countries. This group, however, also poses a danger. It's a demographic time bomb. Many of these young people are either from rural areas or they're in cities but have come from rural areas. Turkish society has not been successful in integrating these people, in providing for their basic needs, in providing jobs for them either on the land or in the cities. Who profits then? What is the group that embraces these young people as they feel increasingly disoriented in their new surroundings? It's the Islamic movement. There have been long periods in Turkey where people working for religious groups would post themselves at the bus station in Ankara and in Istanbul. And when some disoriented person comes off the bus and doesn't really know where to start, these groups offer help. They'll take the guy in for a few weeks, help him find a job, provide the social services that the government doesn't provide. The government doesn't like this, but it can't compete because it's not offering those same services. Turkey needs to be able to integrate its very young population to avoid that population from turning into the kind of angry mass that we've seen in some other Muslim countries.
Is terrorism an issue in Turkey?
Turkey has gone through a military conflict domestically that did involve a lot of terror on both sides. That is the war between the Turkish army and Kurdish rebels. An interesting thing has happened in the last few years there, as I describe in my book. The Kurdish war came to an end, essentially with the defeat of Kurdish rebels at the hands of the Turkish army and the arrest of the Kurdish rebel leader, who remains in prison. As a result of these events and other related processes, the Kurdish movement has become more conciliatory than it ever has in the past. The danger of terror in Turkey, while it still exists, is considerably lessened. But it also raises a very interesting question. The Turkish army is now the only army in the world that has fought and defeated a well-equipped and well-motivated guerrilla force in rugged, mountainous terrain. Will that experience become useful at some time in the near future? It's a question that I'm sure policymakers in Washington and in Ankara are asking themselves now.
Elaborate on what you mean.
The Turks have experience in fighting in a place that's a lot like Afghanistan. They fought against guerrillas who were equipped and motivated to a certain degree like the Taliban fighters in Afghanistan are. One of the lessons the United States has learned too late from its involvement in the Gulf War was that the arrival of outside forces to do a job which might have been done by Muslim forces created a huge backlash. If the United States feels that Muslim forces, the forces from Muslim countries, can play a role in Afghanistan, as I think they can, there is no country whose forces are more equipped to do that than Turkey's. Turkey has also shown in the last decade an increasing interest in becoming involved in international military operations. It's involved all over the Balkans. There have been Turkish troops in Africa. Turkey is a country that can play a military as well as a political role in Afghanistan.
Well, how do you think the Turkish people would feel about that?
Turkey went to fight in South Korea. That was really the first flowering of Turkish military presence since the Turkish Republic was founded. At this moment, I think the Turkish people are absolutely terrified by what they are seeing in Afghanistan. They've had the great discomfort of living next to Iran and Iraq. Now they are seeing something that is their true nightmare happening just one country away, which is in Afghanistan. I think that Turkish involvement in a conflict against the Taliban, if it is handled correctly, would have considerable popular support. It also would be strategically very interesting development, in some ways very productive development possibly for Turkey in terms of its relations with Europe and the United States.
Well, how do Islamic states regard Turkey, and how does Turkey regard them?
Turkey, because of geography and because of the history of the Ottoman Empire, plays a unique role in the Islamic consciousness. The Caliph of Islam was the Sultan for years, and Istanbul was considered the seat of all Islam at certain periods in Islamic history. It has certainly played a key role in the Islamic world for many centuries. So there is a certain status that goes with being Turkish when you're in the Muslim world. However, in certain parts of the Muslim world, Turks are looked at as having been colonizers. They also don't traditionally have a good relationship with Arabs. Turks, in general, look down on Arabs. And there would need to be some work to be done. However, I think the idea of Muslims trying to show, not just with their voices, but in every way, that they reject the Taliban's interpretation of Islam is something that the United States ought to be looking at very carefully now. If there's going to be a Muslim power which is going to posit itself as the anti-Taliban, the example of the other way for Islam, then Turkey is the obvious choice.
As you watch the United States try to put together this coalition with countries around the world in the fight against terrorism, are you seeing new relationships that you're finding quite surprising, and are you wondering what the implications will be for the future in those cases? And if so, maybe you could give us one or two examples of alliances that we're creating with other countries that you find surprising.
Probably the most interesting shift in the geopolitics of this region as a result of the episode on September 11th has been the relation between the United States and Iran. Iran borders on Afghanistan, and the Iranians hate the Taliban regime. You may know that there was an episode not too long ago in which Taliban fighters overran an Iranian consulate in Afghanistan and killed all 10 Iranian diplomats who were there. This just exacerbated long-standing mistrust between the Shiites in Iran and the brand of Islam that the Taliban favors. So the intense hatred between the Iranian regime and the Taliban gives Iran something very much in common with the United States. There have been many strategists in Washington who have been thinking for years of ways in which the United States could move closer to Iran, because our strategic goals in the Middle East are in many cases coincident. This episode has certainly strengthened their hand.
My guest is New York Times reporter Stephen Kinzer, author of the new book Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Kinzer, the New York Times former bureau chief in Istanbul. His new book about Turkey is called Crescent and Star. Stephen Kinzer, while you were the New York Times bureau chief in Istanbul, you were arrested. What were you arrested for?
I was snooping around, as journalists sometimes do, out in eastern Turkey, which is the region where the conflict between the Turkish army and Kurdish rebels was at that time taking place. That war was fought more or less outside of public view. It wasn't possible for Turkish journalists to cover the conflict. It was more or less illegal for them to do so. And it wasn't so welcome for foreign correspondents either. Nonetheless, I was in a car driving around one day when I arrived at my third roadblock of the day and told the lieutenant there that I would be happy to turn around and go back. He said no. And he took me into custody. Later on, I was brought into the basement of a military command post in a provincial capital and kept up all night by people screaming at me, wanting to know what I was doing. They told me they thought I was spying for the PKK, the Kurdish rebel group. It was a very unpleasant 24 hours that I wouldn't want to live through again. On the other hand, I wasn't physically harmed. I came away with some interesting insights, but it cost a bit. I don't want to have to do that every time I go abroad.
What some of the insights being imprisoned and interrogated left you with?
For example, I was told by soldiers that the town that I was trying to get to was a PKK town, that is, a rebel town. Outside in the world of the Turkish media and in the official pronouncements of the Turkish military, there is no such thing as a PKK town. Everybody supports the government. There are only a few wild bands of savage terrorists who are rejected by every civilian that are fighting against the army. the way these soldiers were talking as they were shouting at me in the basement of that jail, the way they kept talking about why I was traveling through pro-PKK areas and into pro-PKK towns, made me realize that the truth, and even the truth that soldiers themselves perceived, was quite different from the truth that we were being told in the newspapers being published in Istanbul.
After living in Turkey for 4 years, you came back to the United States. And, you know, just a few weeks ago, the World Trade Center was attacked. The Pentagon was attacked. What's that experience been like for you to watch this happen to your country?
It has always amazed me to see the extent to which Americans have lived in a bubble, as if they're totally impervious, totally immune to whatever else is happening in the world. We go into countries and take steps that greatly upset their political, social, military, economic balances, and then we just depart, and we expect that that's not going to have any effect. Sometimes I think of that as being like a small child who leaves a trail of garbage and discarded clothes and books wherever he or she goes. Someone has to come by and clean them up, like the man who follows the elephant in the circus. The United States is finally coming to realize that its actions in the world, its alliances, and its policies have effects. These things come back to haunt you. You cannot live in a world where you're totally protected. I think we're in a position now where we've gone from an exaggerated sense of our security in the world to perhaps an exaggerated sense of how insecure and exposed we are. All of it, to me, is a result of the way Americans over the last decades have allowed themselves the luxury of believing that we can live apart from the rest of the world.
So you think we've gone to the opposite extreme and we think we're more vulnerable than we really are?
I do. I read the other day that 50% of Americans, according to one public opinion survey, think it is very likely that they will personally become the victims of terrorist attacks. This kind of exaggeration is perhaps understandable at this moment, but when you've lived in countries in the world where this kind of thing has happened for years, and I'm not just talking about countries like Afghanistan or Pakistan or even Turkey, but countries like England and Spain and Germany, you come to realize that nations have to deal with various kinds of threats and that life can go on despite the immensity of the challenges that these threats pose.
But nothing has ever quite happened like the World Trade Center.
Absolutely not. But I think the impact is even greater in a country in which people had lulled themselves into such a sense of security that they felt that nothing bad could ever happen to them, that the good times were going to go on forever. I've always felt that the United States is more different from the rest of the world than any other country. Americans don't view themselves as part of the world. They've suddenly been thrust into it in a very brutal and horrible way. This is a realization that, admittedly on a smaller scale, people in other countries have come to a long time ago.
Well, Stephen Kinzer, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Stephen Kinzer is the author of the new book Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. He's the former Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times and is now a national correspondent for the Times. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Bob Dylan's new CD. This is Fresh Air.
Yeah.
Love and Theft is Bob Dylan's first CD since 1997's Time Out of Mind. Its official release date was September 11th, the day of the terrorist attacks. Rock critic Ken Tucker says he hears the music on Love and Theft differently than he did in the days before its release.
About a week before the terrorist attacks, I taped a review of Bob Dylan's new CD, Love and Theft. It was an admiring piece, one in which I talked about how pleasurable it was to hear Dylan settle into senior citizenship with jaunty zest and squint-eyed skepticism. Since the events of September 11th, I realized I couldn't let that original review stand as it was, even though the song I originally picked to lead it off, Lonesome Day Blues, still seems the best way to begin. Lonesome Day Blues can now be heard as a kind of prophecy about the loneliness of death, even when you're surrounded by people you know. In one verse that I keep playing over and over, Dylan says, "I'm going to spare the defeated, I'm going to speak to the crowd, I'm going to teach peace to the conquered, I'm going to tame the proud." And who is that talking now? The voice of a leader? A tyrant? A follower? A few weeks ago, it was simply the sound of a man magnifying his loneliness to a metaphor that took in the world. This is the Bob Dylan methodology of four decades.
Every step of the way, we walk the line. Your days are numbered, so am I. Time is piling up, we struggle and we strain. We're all boxed in, nowhere to escape.
What happened on September 11th has moved many people to seize on things, especially anything in the pop culture we find all around us, for new meanings, for explanations, for omens. You can now hear that song, Mississippi, as a quietly terrifying expression about feeling trapped when he sings, quote, "We're all boxed in, nowhere to escape." It's a way the people who died must have felt and, in a more existential sense, a way many people around the country and the world feel now.
All my powers of expression and thoughts so sublime could never do you justice in reason or rhyme. Only one thing I did wrong, stayed in Mississippi a day too long.
September 11th hasn't made me lose my appetite for Dylan's music or for music in general. In fact, listening to new releases by Macy Gray and the hardcore band System of a Down and Loudon Wainwright III and Afro Man has increased my appetite for it. Music not as escape but as engagement with the world. Music as solace but also as an agent of community, as a series of messages that make personal emotions public and open to many interpretations. That's the way I heard much of the music that was played during the benefit telethon that was broadcast September 21st, in songs by people like Bruce Springsteen and Stevie Wonder, and in Neil Young's performance of John Lennon's Imagine. Imagine is one of the songs that was on that list you may have heard about. Clear Channel, a company that owns over 1,000 radio stations, released a list of tunes they recommended not be played out of sensitivity to the catastrophe. Many of the selections seemed absurd. Suddenly, for example, we're not supposed to hear Sam Cooke's What a Wonderful World, lest it upset someone. Such de facto censorship is reprehensible, to be sure, but even timid programmers understand something fundamental. At a time when anything could rightfully upset anyone, an airplane flying over your house, the sight of an absent loved one's shirt on a hanger. Who's to say anymore what can be upsetting?
By and by, I'm breathing a lover's sigh. While I'm sitting on my watch, so I can be on time, I'm singing love's praises with sugar-coated rhyme. By and by, on you I'm casting my eye. I'm painting the town, swinging my partner around. Well, I know who I can depend on, I know who to trust. I'm watching the roads, I'm studying the dust. I'm painting the town, making my last go round. Well, I'm scuffling.
For me, hearing Bob Dylan on a tune called By and By sing phrases like, the future for me is already a thing of the past, and I'm not even acquainted with my old desires, those are upsetting. Upsetting in the way that all good art does when it pierces its way into life. When it, to paraphrase this CD's title, thieves love, stealing it from our emotions. That's something an artist like Dylan can evoke in us, transporting us on a journey to a place in ourselves we didn't know existed.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm going to stand at the defeated. I'm going to speak to the crowd. I'm going to stand at the defeated. Boys, I'm going to speak to the crowd. I'm going to teach peace to the conquered. I'm going to tame the proud. While the leaves are rustling in the wood, things are falling off of the shelf. Leaves are rustling in the wood, things are falling off the shelf. You're going to need my help, sweetheart. You can't make love all by yourself.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, stories of the men who raised the American flag at Iwo Jima during World War II. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how satirists are dealing with the political and cultural aftermath of September 11th. We talk with Harry Shearer and listen to one of his sketches from Le Show, and we check in with the editors of the satirical newspaper, The Onion. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.